for some more. Aki is lecturer at UCL, and that's all I'm going to say.
Yes, I was essentially assigned the same homework as Nora, so you'll be hearing a second paper on the same subject. So I hope I approach this from a slightly different angle. I will first give a brief sketch historiography of the study of Christianization of Scandinavia, then address the theoretical aspect of my assignment from two complementary perspectives. On the one hand, discuss how the application of theory has influenced the study of the Christianization of Scandinavia, and how it could potentially be useful in this field. And first, just a brief sketch of the study of the Christianization process in Scandinavia. I think a defining point in this field was a publication in 1987 of a conference proceedings that was held in Sweden in 1985, the Christianization of Scandinavia, it was called, edited by Ian Wood and Birgit and Peter Sawyer. This volume, in a way, marked a turning point in that it treated the subject from an interdisciplinary perspective and also placed the conversion firmly within an early medieval context, particularly in the context of the Carolingian and the Ottonian world. The contributions in this publication avoid the grand narratives of Christianization of Scandinavia, which are presented in historical works of the 12th and 13th centuries, most notably in Norwegian and Danish Latin works of the 12th century and Icelandic sagas of the 13th and 14th century. So the focus in this publication is very much on the contemporary sources, archaeology, runic inscriptions, Celtic poetry, and inevitably Adam of Bremen. I believe the only literary chapter in this volume relates to Adam of Bremen's history of the Archbishop of Hamburg, Bremen. And this volume, in a way, has set the tone, I think, for the last quarter of a century. The greatest advance, of course, has been in this field has been in archaeology, where the emphasis has been on regional variations in the adaptation of Christianity, particularly as evidenced by burial rites. And I think the book that you've got, a leaflet here with your packets, is probably the latest and a very important contribution by Seifert Nordede on the Christian burials of Norway. But since the publication, there have been new trends. For example, the adoption of a comparative method, which I guess has something to do with the popularity of the concept Europeanization of Europe from the 1990s onwards. And the most excellent contribution to that is, of course, Nora Behrendt's volume, as we mentioned earlier. There have also been very valuable nationally oriented projects, such as the Christianization of Sweden project, which now spans a number of volumes in both Swedish and English. Another trend I've noted is the growing interest in precisely the kind of sources which the conference proceedings I mentioned ignored, that is, the re-inclusion of the narratives of the 12th, 13th, and 14th century, which describe the Christianization, not as sources for the conversion itself, but as interesting sources in their own right, as they show how the Christianization was perceived and continuously reformulated by medieval writers. So although this approach may not tell us what actually happened, I think an awareness of the nature of these sources in a comparative perspective helps us break from the sweeping national narratives of the Christianization I mentioned earlier. So overall, I think the present dominating approach to the Christianization of Scandinavia is, on the one hand, interdisciplinary and comparative, while there is an emphasis on regional differences within Scandinavia and then these inclusion of these literary sources as well. So turning now to the usefulness or otherwise of theories or modern examples. Doing my homework for this project, I was struck by how different the language of sociology in particular is different from what a historian like myself is used to. This theoretical literature is very much dominated by putting things into categories, categories of social and religious phenomena. Categories that are often very divorced or separated from the actual sources or examples. For example, we have a categorization of how the neophyte goes from initial contact with religion until he or she is fully integrated into the religious community. On a macro scale, we have categories that deal with stages that communities go through from first encounter with a new religion until full conversion has been effected, whatever that means. And when these categories are explained, they are usually explained by modern examples. In a usual survey of conversion theories, Louis Rambo lists and explains the nature of 12 theories of conversion, ranging from ritual theory to psychoanalytical theory. And these 12 are by no means the only ones I have encountered in my reading. I will just touch on the ones I find interesting for our present purpose. In the context of the Christianization of Scandinavia, the relevance of the so-called cross-cultural theory seems quite obvious. Indeed, it seems to me that most scholars in this field have unconsciously adopted the main premise of this theory, that is, the recipients of a new religion were not passive receivers, but adopted, often creatively, the religion to their own culture and society. But another useful concept I thought in this cross-cultural theory was a rather bit of a mouthful, cross-cultural psychological theory, which looks at the notion of the hierarchy of the self. To explain, for example, the example used to explain this is usually taken from Japan, where the psychology of conversion is very much shaped by the social structures of Japanese society that makes group conversion far more important and potent than conversion of individuals. In modern day America, on the other hand, the emphasis is very much on individual illumination, for example, in the Pentecostal movement. So, and the reflex of the Western historian is to assume that individual conversion is somehow more important or deeper than group conversion. But in a society, for example, like the Norse society, where interpersonal relationships were of the utmost importance, group conversion were probably the most potent form of conversion we have for the vast majority of people. And I think these sort of perspectives that we get from these theories are useful. Now, coming to anthropological perspectives or anthropological theories, in general, anthropological approaches to medieval Scandinavian history are nothing new. In the 1980s, it appeared that the Icelandic Commonwealth, for example, presented historians with the perfect sources for adopting anthropological models and approaches. The School of Legal and Anthropological Studies was not so much dealing with specific theories, but rather the application of concepts such as honor, blood feud, reciprocity, gift exchange, and so on. But the problem is that this methodological approach to the Commonwealth, this anthropological approach to the Commonwealth, led to an ahistorical, essentially static view of society, where, for example, religion was mostly absent. And this anthropological approach became quite fashionable in the 1980s and 90s, but in relation to the Icelandic Commonwealth appears to have stagnated somewhat, primarily, I suggest, because of the unsolved methodological problems involved. In Danish and Norwegian historiography, however, the legal anthropological school has exerted major influence in the last decade or so. And the term the political game, for example, has become ubiquitous. It is fair to say that anthropological theories have not been applied to the Christianization of Scandinavia to any noticeable extent. And this may be explained, at least that would be my theory, that the application of anthropological approach is essentially static, or that's how structuralist, or that's how it has been applied in Scandinavian medieval studies, whereas the nature of the conversion or Christianization is dynamic and changing. The only exception I could think of was the application of central place theory in relation to pagan society, which is obviously influenced by structural anthropology. But I think there are still terms and concepts from anthropology that are useful. For example, the idea of Christianity as something that kings had in their possession to give to their subjects. This is certainly suggested by some of the contemporary Celtic poetry, and it's very common in the 13th and 14th century sagas. That is, the importance of Christianity as some as an elite preservation that the kings could bestow on their followers. In sociology, we might look towards the possible usefulness of migration theory, and Ori mentioned this briefly in his talk, and its relevance to religious change. That is how politics, social organization, and religion changes with immigration or emigration. And this would, I believe, only apply to Iceland for obvious reasons, and I know Ori Vestnason has worked on this and in relation to the settlement of Iceland. After all, Iceland was colonized by people, mostly pagans, I presume, who uprooted themselves, or were uprooted, from the home region which had provided the foundation for their pre-Christian religion. How do people react who are thus moved from their deeply rooted religious environment to completely new land? Here, the migration theory might possibly be of use, but the problem is, of course, that the Icelandic case is singular. There are no other examples that I can think of. New Zealand is probably the one that is the nearest parallel. We could argue this both ways. The loosening of ties with the local region back in Norway or the British Isles could have slackened the ties of the pagan religion and thus made the shift to Christianity easier, and this seems to be Ori Vestnason's theory. On the other hand, we could also argue that it was precisely the exceptionality of the Icelandic situation, the absence of any host society for the earliest immigrants, which allowed a small elite to dominate religious matters in a way which had not been the case in Norway, but it seems that Ori is of the former view in this matter. One theory that I wasn't expecting to meet here during my reading was post-colonial theory. But I did come across, this does have a relevance to this topic. In older Icelandic historical works on the Icelandic Commonwealth, the Christianization and the Church, early 20th century works, Christianity was usually presented as an alien element in the Icelandic national body. The independence of the Icelandic nations was thus seen in opposition to the international Catholic Church. And this was obviously very much conditioned on Icelandic nationalism of the early 12th century, combined with ingrained, I guess, Protestant prejudice. In Denmark and partly in Norway, this foreign intrusion had an institutional face in the shape of the Archbishopric of Hamburg-Bremen, which, of course, was a part of the German imperial polity. Now, it's probably correct to think that this sort of attitude, that is, German bad, Anglo-Saxon influence good, has disappeared. But I noted that in the New Cambridge History of Scandinavia, there's a chapter called the Emancipation of the Scandinavians from Hamburg-Bremen. So there seems to be at least unconscious attitude of this sort. So how does this relate to post-colonial theory? Well, it seems that similar sentiments appear under different forms, not under the guise of nationalism, represented by the native and international church and Christianity, but rather in the interaction between the rulers and the ruled. In other words, in this approach, the tendency is to see the Christianization as an instrument of essentially colonial mindset. This approach brings together a Marxist notion of an elite which controlled religion, learning, and had a monopoly of power, attaching itself to the new religion and using it for its own purpose. In other words, the Christianization is seen as being a foreign body used by a native elite to support their own position. The examples I'm taking here are from a PhD by a former Anschlag student, Eric Niblers, who discusses this briefly in his PhD. And the bogeyman here is Hamburg Bremen again. And Hamburg Bremen attains a new significance as the carrier of Western imperialism. I quote here from one Swedish article, the intolerant Frankist imperial priesthood is mentioned in this article. In another study, Hamburg Bremen, representing Western Christianity, threatened the annihilation of, quote, multi-religious inclusive system that existed in Scandinavia prior to the conversion. So here we are looking at examples where intersections of modern concerns with imperialism and globalization in conjunction with theory results in an anachronistic and misleading view of the Christianization process. Well, that's my view at least. So my other assignment was to look at modern examples, and the one I could think of, how modern examples have influenced the study of the Christianization of Scandinavia, was that of Birkeli, who has been mentioned a couple of times here, at least yesterday. Now, Birkeli, who was a Norwegian historian, but also the Bishop of Oslo, ended up as a Bishop of Oslo, presented a three states theory of the conversion, that is, initial contact through Viking raids and so on and so forth, followed by the conversion of the rulers and their efforts to introduce a religion, and thirdly, the establishment of an ecclesiastical structure. And I think this structure has been adopted consciously or unconsciously by most scholars working in the field, and he published this in 1973, I think the first presentation of this theory. Now, the interesting thing is that Birkeli himself was inspired to present this model by his own experience as a Lutheran missionary in Madagascar, in the, I believe that was in the 1930s. He was struck by the slow process of Christianization in Madagascar, that is, the how these three phases that he presented in relation to Norway he found in his missionary work in Madagascar. So that's one modern example, and I don't have another one, but I'll let that be. So in conclusion, I think not very original conclusion, I'm afraid, that the theories and modern examples can present interesting new and inspiring perspectives, but should be avoided as ideological or dogmatic schemas. Thank you.